Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Guy Fawcett grew up hearing about the shenanigans of his recent ancestors, the eight Fawcett boys who grew up around the towns of Snoqualmie and Monroe back in the 1920s.
Well, there was a lot of betting back in the days, horse racing, wrestling, boxing matches. A lot of these entailed liquor, fighting, cheating.
This is Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and Guy told us about one Fawcett brother in particular, a man named Al Fawcett, who was always getting into something. Al was Guy's great-grandfather. He made money in a variety of ways: horse racing, logging, real estate.
One article talked about 1925, how he went to the manager of the bank in Duval, Washington, and punched him out for a real estate transaction he didn't get his full cut on. And Al was promptly jailed and fined $5 and released. Al's wife had had enough of him and promptly divorced him when he decided his career was going to change and he was going to become a daredevil.
Al's daredevil act would center on those epic features of the Pacific Northwest, waterfalls. He built a boat and hauled it out to Sunset Falls on the South Fork of the Skykomish River. This was 104 vertical feet of certain depth, which Al chose as his test run. He survived. Next, Al Fawcett had to find a way to make this activity pay.
When you came and paid a dollar to watch him go over the falls, he'd set up betting booths on the property, and he needed you to come and bet that he would not survive this, because that's how he made his money. He needed you to bet that he was going to die.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is cheating death. Stories of defying the odds and living to tell the tale. Back now to Al Fawcett, the daredevil who made his living defying death. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing picks up the story from here.
Guy Fawcett says that when his great-grandfather Al Fawcett announced that his next career move was becoming a daredevil, it wasn't a totally out-of-left-field choice.
It was the 20s, and you'd start hearing about wing walkers on biplanes, and you had pole sitting in town.
Pole sitting. It was a thing. People perched themselves on top of flagpoles for fun. People shot out of cannons. Construction workers did the Charleston on iron beams, high up on skyscrapers they were building. And tightrope walkers inched across deep canyons.
He made him the slightest error that would send him hurtling down into space and certain death. But once again, this aerial artist cheats death and walks off to the safety of an alpine mountain peak.
And, you know, there was no television or not much radio. Radio was a relatively new deal. So anything that was going on, you brought your whole family to town.
Al Fawcett was a slim man with a head full of hair and a face that was creased from many hours working out in the sun with horses and cattle. His successful trip over Sunset Falls was confirmation that this daredevil act could actually work.
Had a crowd of about 3,500 people for his first ever attempt and made just under $2,000, and that's where he got his taste for this.
Again, the way Al made money, thousands of dollars at each drop, was to get people to part with their dollars by placing bets against his survival. Sunset Falls was just the beginning.
After that, he went over Eagle Falls and Index, Canyon Falls in the same area. Then he went on to Spokane to go over Spokane Falls. Traveled down to Oregon, went over Willamette Falls in Oregon City, Oregon, and down to Silverton, Oregon, went over the Main South Falls. He bought the property for that one surrounding the falls because he wanted to do it every weekend. Bad plan that was. He was basically what they referred to even way back in the day as a one-man parade. He would parade his boats to whatever town he was in by himself towing it, and he would announce to the public that that evening he would be showing his own private motion pictures at the local theater of his past falls jumps. And he would get up on stage and talk about how dangerous it was and how he had cheated death once again. And then he went on to Idaho to to do some falls jumping over there. The biggest falls he did was in Idaho. It was 212-foot Shoshone Falls. And every falls he did was higher and more dangerous than the last one.
Al Fawcett kept defying death. For these stunts, he was always dressed in a pressed shirt and tie, just in case the day turned into a funeral. The thing that was preventing Al's body from being completely crumpled on the rocks at the bottom of all of these waterfalls was called a boat, even though it didn't really look like one. It was a hollowed-out log that was banded back together with metal. Al was tucked inside. It looked more like a torpedo or a cigar.
Most of the early ones were wooden, handcrafted boats that the Pilchuck tribal members in the Snohomish areas, who were his friends, helped him craft these boats. Later on, he decided that he kept getting injured and the boats took a good battering, so he designed a big canvas bag, basically what it was, and he would climb into it and they would pack inner tubes in it, and he called it a safety boat. Well, that one didn't work out really good. He had some of his biggest injuries ever inside his new safety boat. Most of the injuries were chest and stomach injuries, bruised kidneys, liver, numerous broken ribs.
Despite these injuries, he always survived. You're probably thinking that Al is a young man in his 20s, maybe early 30s, but no. He started his daredevil career at age 46, on the older side for the physical beatings he took. He quit at 51. The Great Depression hit, and people didn't have any spare cash to bet on a man's life. After a brief try at boxing and being a Hollywood stuntman, Al retired in Portland. But there was one waterfall he could not stop thinking about.
These sensational pictures were taken by Movietone's cameramen at the world-famous Niagara Falls.
He had all the proper documentation and permission to jump the falls. He always wanted to do Niagara his whole life. He was finally going to achieve that goal.
When he was in his late 60s, Al started building a boat inside his house in downtown Portland. Family pleaded with him to reconsider his plan. Al never got to Niagara Falls or any other waterfalls. He died in bed from complications of all of the internal injuries he suffered over the years. At age 68, his daredevil career finally caught up with him. Guy Fawcett says that his great-grandfather went over so many waterfalls for the obvious reason, fame and fortune. But Al was also trying to stand apart from his 8 brothers and 2 sisters, hoping to catch the eye of one particular person.
It was for the attention of his mother, because there was 8 boys in the family and 2 girls, and he just wanted to be mom's favorite.
After Al died, the family had to figure out what to do with the boat that he was working on for Niagara Falls. The hunk of wood was so big that to get it out of the house, a wall had to be removed, and a tow truck was needed to haul it outside. Instead of cresting over a waterfall, the boat went to the neighbors, who used it for firewood.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. We're telling stories of cheating death today on Sound Effect, and this next tale of a brush with mortality takes place underwater. That's a world that's normally a haven for Katie Morgan. Katie works with us here at KNKX, and she's also a longtime serious scuba diver. She's been at it for decades, ever since she got hooked on scuba in Hawaii.
My first dive was off the shore, and we dove into these James Bond-like caves where there was an air pocket. So you get up and sit on the side. And then we went to the next one. It was the Cave of the 5 Sharks or something like that. And so 30-some-odd years later, I'm still diving. I suppose it's like a drink to an alcoholic. You don't think about anything else. You don't think about finances, relationships, work, anything else but what's in front of you. I've always wanted to dive at the underwater dome in the Seattle Aquarium. It is a 400,000 gallon tank. So there's 105 windows all the way around. And so they have a 360 degree view of what's going on. It's a commitment. It's every other week. My role at the Seattle Aquarium is a volunteer diver. I do the afternoon feeding shift in the dome. So we take some food down from the Pike Place Market, and we take it down and we talk to the kids and we feed the fish. We have intercoms that where we can speak through the speakers in the dome. We talk about anything from ocean plastics to acidification or just questions that the kids may have.
We have Katie, and Katie, you've got a host of fish that are kind of schooling around underneath you and nibbling at your goodie bag. What kind of fish are those?
Why, those are perch. They're, you'll see them in the water in the pilings.
And I don't feed fish in the wild, so to be able to snuggle with a wolf eel and, you know, feed it squid and have it, you know, just rest negatively in my arm, I love that. So I wasn't feeling great. There wasn't anything that was keeping me from diving. It wasn't a sinus thing or a congestion thing. So I geared up, got in the water, started feeding the fish, and talking to the kids. During the show, I don't think that there was a problem except for I kept floating up and I'd let some air out and then I'd sink too fast. So I used my left hand to let air out or put air in this buoyancy compensator device. So I must have been having difficulty with my hand at that time. And so I just couldn't figure out why I couldn't get my buoyancy down. I was up and down and up and down. And then once our dive was done, we've wiped down all the windows. We get up to the ladder. And I was having such a hard time getting up the ladder. I was weak. But I didn't know why I was weak. So I was just having an off day, but I didn't really know what was going on. And when I was falling into the railing as I was going down the spiral staircase, and then when I got into the bathroom and the suit that I was wearing felt like it was made of lead, and I just wanted to sit down in the middle of the floor. And that's when I knew that I needed help, because I would never sit down in the middle of a public restroom. So that's when I called for help. As soon as we got to Swedish, it was the expression on the doctor's face that initially terrified me. And that's when I knew I was in trouble. And then they whisked me off and I got an MRI and several CAT scans, and he said, "You've had a stroke." They told me where in the brain it was, and he showed me some images. As I was in the hospital, I lost more mobility. I couldn't use my left hand. I could no longer move my toes. My face went completely slack on the left. That was terrifying. Because honestly, my identity is based around the fun things that I do. I mean, I literally work to live. And so if all of that is gone, it was just sort of hard to deal with. Most of my friendships are based on the activities that I do. It wasn't that I didn't think that they were good people. It was just like, I can no longer do any of these things. And do I lose that whole network of people that I absolutely love to hang out with? I felt very small. I hated the way I looked. I hated the way that I couldn't move, and I really didn't want to speak to anybody about it. I like to think of myself as strong, and if you tell me I can't do something, that's usually all the encouragement I need to figure it out or how to find a way to make something work. I didn't realize at that time I've lost that person. I just knew that, I guess I was scared. I had plans to dive with a buddy the following weekend, but I was also going down to my aunt's funeral. And so on Friday when I got out of the hospital, he's texting. He's a good dive buddy, but you just don't know how decent people are until something bad happens. He offered to drive me all the way to Portland and back just for my aunt's funeral. And he didn't pry with questions. And so I brought people into the fold one by one. I think it was within a month or a month and a half. The same buddy was patient with me. And we went down to Alki. It's about a mile from my home. And we tried to go down. And I couldn't get past 8 feet without it just crushing my skull. So the space in between my skull and my brain felt, there was just a horrific pain. So he just let me sit there for however long it took. And then I got down a little further, and then we did a dive, but I wasn't comfortable. So the next time I went down, we just took time and sat in green water for, I don't know, 20 minutes, half an hour, just until I could get there. I wasn't really ready at that point. That was probably late August, early September, but it was something that kept me going. I am different than I was. Hopefully I'm better. It's different. I let people help me. It's difficult for me, but when I first started diving, it was a different atmosphere. There were lots of women doing it, not as many as today, but the attitude was that if you can't do everything yourself, you should not be doing this at all. So I have trouble accepting help, but I am open to it because I think that if there was somebody in the pity party for one stage, to hear that you can go from that to diving the Galapagos. I spent the 1 year anniversary of the stroke building houses in Malawi and swimming in the Devil's Pool at the edge of Victoria Falls. It just, that's the message, that it's possible to come out of it. Maybe not 100% and definitely different, but you'll come out okay.
Katie Morgan works in corporate sponsorship here at KNKX, and she's a volunteer diver at the Seattle Aquarium. For her next big trip, she's planning on heading to the waters off the coast of South Africa. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week's theme is Cheating Death. Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing and I meet Laureen Nussbaum in the lobby of a retirement home in North Seattle.
This is Gabriel.
Hi, Laureen.
I'm Laureen. Laureen is a petite woman. She's 92 years old, and she insists on helping us with our gear.
Can I carry something?
Oh, I'm good.
Well, but just give me your coat, I think.
Oh, sure. You can take my coat, yes.
And with that, Laureen glides up an enormous spiral staircase carrying Jennifer's coat.
I love these steps.
The fact that Laureen is here at all is pretty incredible. Laureen grew up in a Jewish family in Germany and later Nazi-occupied Amsterdam during World War II. The vast majority of people who fit that description did not survive. But Laureen did, in part because of the very laws the Nazis used to decide who was worthy of extermination. There were lots of fuzzy cases, mixed families, conversions. Somebody had to make the call when there were these cases of so-called doubtful ancestry. In the Netherlands, that someone was a German bureaucrat named Hans Kallmayr. He is the reason that Lorene and, by extension, we are meeting here today. She wrote a book about him in her 90s called Shedding Our Stars, the story of Hans Kallmayr and how he saved thousands of families like mine.
He just did not believe any of the anti-Jewish propaganda.
But before we get deeper into that, we head into her tidy mid-century modern apartment. She brings out an old photo album and flips through black and white pictures. One shows Lorene and her childhood sweetheart, Rudy Nussbaum, in a doorway on the day of their wedding.
Beautiful. You guys are such a gorgeous couple. Wow.
People came out and Otto Falk is standing behind the pane here. He was our best man at a wedding.
That's the Otto Frank, the father of Anne, whose writings were later published as Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. Lorene's parents, Marianne and Joseph Klein, were friends with Otto Frank and his wife Edith. Both families fled Germany for the Netherlands, which was neutral at the time, and settled in the same neighborhood. Lorene got to know the Franks' daughters, Margot and Anne. Lorene looked up to Margot, who was 2 years older.
She was ladylike, she was composed. I thought, wouldn't it be nice to be a lady like her?
Lorene remembers Anne, who was a bit younger than her, as a very chatty kid, usually surrounded by friends and known for having a lot of opinions.
In fact, one of her friends once said, the good Lord knows everything, but Anne knows it better.
What no one knew at the beginning was that the fates of these two families would go in two completely different directions, one toward doom and the other toward salvation. Lorene says at the beginning of the war, before people knew about the horrors at places like Treblinka and Auschwitz, life was bearable. She went to school and studied foreign languages. She rode her bike everywhere and soon got to know a handsome older boy named Rudy. He would visit the Kleins and play piano.
We had a cellist, a very dear man, who played the cello, and then my sister and or I would play the violin. Rudy would play the piano, or my mother would play the piano. So Haydn trios, some Mozart trios.
After the Germans invaded the Netherlands in May of 1940, life for Jews began to change. More and more restrictions appeared. Jews couldn't go to regular schools. They could only shop at certain hours. By the summer of 1942, Jews in Amsterdam were banned from public transportation, even from riding bicycles.
Eventually, all of us had to hand over our bicycles, so we had to walk.
To mark Jews as separate from the rest of society, they had to wear a yellow star every time they went out of their homes.
Yes, the yellow star, I think it hails from the Middle Ages, to mark Jews as being not really part of the society.
The anti-Jewish actions escalated until, periodically, green vans would appear at each end of the block, like bookends. Nazi officers and Dutch Nazi police would swarm the neighborhood and round up anyone they suspected of being Jewish.
They would come to knock at each door and ask whether there were any Jews, or look at you and ask for your papers and round up the Jews in the building. That was door by door.
How close did those get to you?
Well, they got into our apartment on August the 6th of 1942 and rounded up my mother and my sisters and myself. My father wasn't home, mercifully.
As they were held, Lorene's mother lodged a protest. She told the Nazis that she had an appeal pending before Hans Kallmayr, that bureaucrat who was deciding the tricky cases of who was and wasn't a Jew. The Germans sent them home to wait for a decision.
So we were let go because our case was on the Kallmayr list, and it was a pending case.
Word was, Kallmayr was quietly sympathetic to the Jews' plight. The trick was to have convincing paperwork, even if it was bogus. He didn't take bribes, and he wasn't swayed by tears. But if the paperwork was at least plausible, he'd give the person the benefit of the doubt. For Lorene's family, their hopes rested on her great-grandmother, her late Jewish, prejudiced great-grandmother.
If my mother's Jewish grandmother had not been such a hopeless bigot, we would not be alive.
Here's how it happened. Lorene's grandfather fell in love and wanted to marry, but the woman he loved was Catholic and that infuriated his mother.
Not over my dead body will you marry a non-Jewish woman.
Lorene's grandfather abided by his mother's wishes. He lived with his non-Jewish partner and then had a daughter, who was Lorene's mother. But they did not get married, not for 20 years, until his mother had died. And this, in retrospect, was the loophole that Lorene's family needed. It gave Hans Kallmeier, the German lawyer, enough ammo to say Lorene's grandfather could have been a Gentile.
Kallmeier, I have it in his writing, said, well, the mother of this woman was clearly not Jewish. Who am I to say that the father was Jewish? My office cannot ferret this out. So this woman, my mother, is not Jewish, period.
So your mother was declared non-Jewish by the Hans Kallmeier office for dubious cases.
Yeah.
And it was okay that your father was Jewish in this case because there was a thing about privileged mixed marriages, right? So was that the ticket for you then?
Sure. It happened in January of 1943, and my mother and my sisters and I could take off our stars. That's why I called the book Shedding Our Stars, because we shed them like a reptile sheds a skin, you know. And my father was then covered by being married to a non-Jewish wife with half-Jewish children.
This scenario played out again and again. A Jewish family would go to Kallmeier with just enough reasonable doubt, and he'd find in their favor. When there wasn't enough evidence to declare someone non-Jewish, at least in a way that would stand up to scrutiny, he'd often stall the process long enough for people to escape. As the Kleins were shedding their stars, as she puts it, like reptiles shed their skin, Lorene's childhood sweetheart had gone into hiding in a farmhouse out in the country. Being classified as a non-Jew allowed Lorene to help him.
I always knew where he was. I was his liaison. In a way, he depended on me for anything that had to do with the outside world.
Lorene brought Rudy books and food. Sometimes he'd sneak back into Amsterdam in the dark to visit Lorene and her family. In secret, they'd again take up their instruments and play chamber music. Meanwhile, by winter of 1943, the Kleins were suffering along with most of occupied Amsterdam. They had no electricity, no heat, and barely anything to eat.
Well, at the low point, we had no more than 200 calories a day, and a normal person needs 2,000, so you can see that we were literally starving.
They ate the beets that farmers raised to feed pigs.
They are very sweet, but they are by far more tasty than tulip bulbs. Tulip bulbs are bitter, they are awful, so we ate those too.
How do you prepare tulip bulbs?
Well, what could we do? We boiled them with water. We didn't have any butter or anything else.
The Franks, of course, went into hiding at some point, too. What do you remember about how that unfolded?
Well, that's a question I have been asked so often, and it always tickles me. You ask it more carefully. People say, what did you think when the Franks suddenly disappeared? I thought absolutely nothing, because everybody else disappeared. Why should I think particularly of the Franks? It always shows me that however much I talk, people can't get themselves into the situation. You go to school, and all of a sudden, the girl who was next to you isn't there anymore. And you knew better than to ask. You could be tortured in order to give somebody away. So we didn't ask questions. We were much too wise for that.
What Lorene would find out later is that the Frank family had been discovered, rounded up, and sent to concentration camps. Anne Frank would die there early the next year. So would Margot, who Lorene admired for being so ladylike, and their mother Edith. Only Otto Frank survived. The two families' fates went in opposite directions, and the point where they diverged was that decision from the German bureaucrat Hans Kallmeier. Lorene's boyfriend, Rudy, also survived the war. Lorene and Rudy had three children and ended up settling in Portland. They both joined the faculty at Portland State University. Lorene taught languages and literature, and Rudy was a professor of physics. Lorene didn't fully understand her family's survival story and the role that Hans Kallmeier played until decades after the war. And here's what she discovered. Kallmeier wasn't indifferent to the Nazi laws against Jews. He actively and secretly opposed them. He never joined the Nazi Party and was an avowed socialist. He hired a Jewish secretary and clashed regularly with the Nazi brass. A doctor once refused to treat his son because Kallmeier was a, quote, Jew lover. But he was a meticulous lawyer, careful enough to cover his tracks and work within the law. even a monstrous law.
Kammerer played it as carefully as he could, and he denied some people, and there were actually, after the war, there still are Dutch people who think that he could have and should have saved more people, but he couldn't save them all. It would have been too transparent. As it was, he was already known as the Jews Kallmeyer and so on. If the war had lasted just a little longer, he would have found out.
What do you feel when you think about Hans Kallmeyer at this point?
Unfortunately, it's all very relevant again, because we live in such a dismal period, historical period. Neo-fascism is on the rise, and it's anti-Semitism, it's anti-Islam, and it's horrible. And if there's one thing that I'm sadly have to take to my grave, is that we, my generation, who were so sure that what happened to us should never happen again, and tried, apparently didn't try hard enough. At least we didn't get anywhere. I think things are much worse now than they have been in a long, long time.
So do you think of Kallmeyer as an example for people who want to do the right thing in a very difficult circumstance now?
I want people to take away that, like Hans Kallmeyer, you should always take responsibility and help and do good as much as you can, wherever you are in life. I think that's the important message really for me.
That's Laureen Nussbaum, age 92. She's the author of the book Shedding Our Stars, the story of Hans Kallmeyer and how he saved thousands of families like mine. Laureen and Rudy were married for 64 years until he died in 2011. After the war, Hans Kallmeyer was briefly jailed for suspicion of war crimes. He was eventually released and lived out his years quietly. He died in 1972. Historians would later figure that Kallmeyer saved between 3 and 4,000 Jews. That's several times more than the much better known Oskar Schindler. 20 years later, Yad Vashem, Israel's official Holocaust memorial, recognized Kallmeyer with the posthumous title, Righteous Among the Nations. It's Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today it's stories of cheating death. So think of a disease, like a really bad one.
Cancer, dementia, diabetes, kidney disease.
That's Matt Kaberline, a professor in the Department of Pathology at the University of Washington. He says that all of these diseases share one major risk factor.
And that risk factor isn't what people would normally think of. It's not how much you eat or how much alcohol you drink or whether you exercise. It's how old you are.
The longer you live, the likelier it is that one of those illnesses will catch up with you. It's just kind of a fact of life. But Professor Kaberline and others in the field of gerontology say it might not have to be that way. They want to prevent those sicknesses not by targeting the diseases themselves, but by delaying the onset of aging. It's a lot to wrap your head around, and it can conjure up some sci-fi, even dystopian visions. But Kaberline says that's off base. And his latest project invites us to think about extending lifespan in a much cuter, furrier kind of way. More on that soon. But first, Kaberline explained the advantage of focusing on aging rather than on individual diseases with a thought experiment.
If you consider a typical 50-year-old woman, and we ask what would the effect on life expectancy be of curing cancer? So if we had a pill that could cure all forms of cancer, it turns out that for the typical 50-year-old woman, the increase in life expectancy would be about 3 years. So it's maybe not as big as people would expect. And that's because even if we cure one disease of aging, that 50-year-old woman continues to get older and continues to increase her risk for developing dementia, diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease, right? So there's, even if you fix one thing, there are all these other diseases of aging that are still out there. If we compare that to the effect of slowing aging directly, you know, by about 20%, let's say, which is routine in laboratory animals, that same 50-year-old woman gets about a two-decade increase in life expectancy with the added value that those extra years are expected to be free from all of those other diseases of aging.
So when you like tell lay people at a dinner party or something like that what you do, what you study, what kind of reactions do you get?
Most of the time, people are interested. They think that the biology of aging is interesting. It's not something that most people have really thought about as an area of biology. I think certainly there are some people who will say, well, you're playing God. And I understand that perception. But my sort of counter argument to that is that, you know, really our goal is very similar to the goal of curing cancer. We just want to maximize health of people. And so from that perspective, it's no more playing God than doing surgery to remove a tumor. I think the other argument that I've heard against studying the biology of aging is that there are ethical concerns with slowing the aging process. And those range from, you know, the potential inequities of any intervention that gets developed. Maybe it will only be for the rich. Concerns about overpopulation of the planet. Concerns that we need to make room for the next generation, you know, in terms of career opportunities. And I think those are all interesting ethical conversations to have. But again, I come back to the point that if you want to make those arguments about targeting the biology of aging, you kind of have to make the same argument about treating heart disease or treating cancer or treating dementia. Because again, in all of those things, the goal is to enhance healthy longevity of people.
So thinking now of this current, I guess, you know, early clinical trial in a model organism, can you just sort of walk us through how you got to the idea for it?
You know, there are really two goals to the Dog Aging Project. The sort of overarching goal is really to understand the biological aging process in pet dogs. We also had the opportunity to actually do something about it because the field had developed to the point where we now have interventions that really seem to slow the aging process, at least in laboratory animals. And being somebody who's always had dogs and has three dogs now, and I love my dogs, I thought it would be awesome if I could actually help not only my dogs, but everybody's dogs live longer and healthier. And so the intervention that we picked is a drug called rapamycin. And the reason that we picked that particular intervention is that's the intervention where there's the best data in laboratory mice for not only increasing lifespan, but broadly improving function across all of the tissues and organs of the animal, with the important additional feature that we knew, again, at least in mice, you could start the treatment in middle age. So you could take a mouse that's about the equivalent of, say, a 60-year-old person, start the treatment at that point, and still get all of these benefits in terms of delayed aging, and in many cases, actually restoring function of certain tissues back to a more youthful state.
So when you tell people about the Dog Aging Project, how would you say the reactions compare with when you tell them about, you know, the broader questions that you're looking at?
It's night and day. I mean, people by and large are very excited to be a part of something that could have the potential to have an impact both on canine health and longevity, but also on health and longevity in people. And so I would say, you know, 99% of the people I talk to are extremely excited about the project, and most of them want to have their dog participate.
To what extent do you hope that the Dog Aging Project clears a glide path for more investment in human anti-aging efforts?
You know, it's almost certain that much of what we've learned so far will have impacts on human aging. And I think once that's clearly established and accepted, the money will flow. So I'm not too concerned that it's not going to happen. I think where we can have a much greater impact is by getting sort of emotional acceptance from the general public. I think that the idea of helping people's dogs live longer and healthier by modulating aging it's easier for much of the general public to accept than the idea of targeting aging directly in human beings. And so I think that from a sort of public recognition perspective, we can have a huge impact, especially if, let's say 5 years from now, we're able to say, we have a clinically demonstrated way to slow aging in your dogs. I think that would be important to a lot of people.
Matt Kaeberline leads the Kaeberline Lab at the University of Washington, where he's co-director of the Dog Aging Project. It's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our last story of cheating death comes from storyteller Obi Pressman. Of course, no one can cheat death in the long run. Sometimes it's about squeezing out just a little extra time and a little more meaning from life. Obi's story is about encountering someone in those late stages of life and finding an unexpected connection. He told it at Sound Effect's live storytelling event over the summer.
The ad read, "Help wanted, with chores around the house, heavy lifting, and going for walks. Weekday afternoons, $12 an hour cash." Even for the classifieds and the local weekly, it struck me as a little odd, and I knew I wasn't getting the whole story. But I needed a job, and I needed a win. The last year had been the hardest of my entire life. My parents had gone bankrupt, losing everything, including our family home. My father then left my mother for another woman. And within a month of that, my college girlfriend of 2 years told me she was leaving me for another guy, and I had to move out of our shared place. So by the time the school year came to an end, I was just looking for any way to feel stable and all right. So I screwed up my courage, and I called the number listed. And the phone rang and rang and rang. And finally it picks up, and it's this breathless older woman's voice, and she says, "Hello?" And I say, "Hi, I'm calling about the ad." She says, "Okay, tell me about yourself." And I do. And she says, "Okay, why don't you come over tomorrow and I'll tell you about my situation." So the next day, I find her place and I knock on the door. And again, there's this long pause. And finally, she opens the door. She invites me in and we go sit down in the living room. And she tells me her story. Mary's heart was failing her, and she was on a waiting list for a transplant. But in the meantime, her doctors wanted her to stay as active as she possibly could. And she needed help with this because her husband worked long hours during the week. She said, "What do you think?" And it was a revelatory moment for me, because despite all the trouble that I had just had with these other people in my life, I could help this woman. And I said to her, "I would love to do this." And she said, "Oh, good. Let's go for a walk right now." And so we got up, I gave her my arm, and out we went. And it was a beautiful summer afternoon, and we strolled through it arm in arm. And then after a little bit, she got tired, and we sat down, and it gave me a minute to reflect. And it was the first time in months that I felt completely at ease. And I didn't want or need to be anywhere but in that precise moment. And then she got her breath back, and we got up, and we finished her walk. And when we were done, she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Sign me up, please." And she said, "Oh, great." And she paid me for my time there, and I was on my way. And from then on afternoons, I'd head over to Mary's place. And some days I'd help around the house. Other days we'd go for walks. And sometimes she couldn't do anything but to sit and talk. And she had all of these amazing stories because her husband's work had taken them all around the world. And she'd raised her children in all these different places. And now her children were grown, and she was so proud of them. And of course she had grandchildren, and she loved and adored them. And that's how the summer passed. And then one Saturday morning, I was driving down the freeway, and out of seemingly nowhere, my heart just starts to ache for Mary, like she is the love of my life. Which is weird, because although I cared for her at that point, I didn't feel that way about her. But it is as if we are in the midst of a torrid romance, and she is the love of my life. And it is so overpowering and so all-consuming, I almost pull over right there on the freeway and go to Mary. But it is also so crazy, and out of the blue, I just think to myself, whatever this is, it's just gonna pass. I gotta go about my day. So I do. That night, when I got home, there was a message on the answering machine. And it's from Mary's husband. unexpectedly, she'd gone into surgery that morning. And it had been a success. She'd gotten a new heart. And the first thing she did when she woke up was ask for me. So I called him up and I said, can I come visit? And he said, sure, come by tomorrow. The next day in the car, while I'm driving to the hospital, I'm trying to do everything I can not to speed. And by the time I get there and park and get inside, I am practically running through the halls. And when I burst into her room, she is up in her hospital bed, surrounded by her family. And I run up to her to give her a hug. And she grabs my face with both of her hands. And she plants a big kiss right on my face in front of everybody. But it feels like the thing to do. So I kiss her back. And then I sit down and I take her hand. And when I do, a flood, a tidal wave of emotion comes pouring out of my heart, and I can't do anything but just sit and be with the emotions. And then after a little while, I start to feel normal again, and Mary starts to get tired and wants to rest. So I say, okay, Mary, I'll see you tomorrow. And I go. In the car ride back, I am thinking to myself, what in the hell was that? See, here's the thing. I'm a pretty rational guy. I like to base my decisions on data and my understandings on evidence and science. But I kept coming back to the same conclusion. I couldn't get away from it. Over the course of the summer, Mary had been taking all these cherished memories and emotions and feelings and giving them to me to hold in my heart for her. And when she got her new heart, she needed them back. And even though my mind didn't know this was going on, or what all these feelings were about, or what to even do with them, my heart most certainly did. A few weeks later, I got a letter from Mary. And in it was a check for $500, and the words, I want you to take this as a small token of my appreciation. I couldn't have gotten through this summer without you, and I only wish that I could give you more. But the thing that Mary didn't realize is that she had given me at least as much as I had given her, and that we were both more complete people for having known each other that summer. She, with her new heart and her health, and me, with a renewed sense of faith in myself and in the healing power of the people and relationships in my life. And I still carry that with me today, right here in my heart.
Obi Pressman told his story at our live event at The Collective in Seattle. You can hear more of those stories at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Paul Currington of Fresh Ground Stories and Kari Ploke. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. Treat yourself to some stories this holiday season. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you get your audio. And if you're wondering what gift I want this year, and I know you are, it's for you to rate and review our podcast. We're back next week when our theme is Dream On. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.